STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hey friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and glad you're with me today, and I'm glad I'm with you today. And before I get rolling here, I have one of my favorite buddies on the line to talk about one of my favorite events in my yearly calendar. That would be Cross Examined Instructor Academy coming up in August in Dallas. My buddy is, of course, Mr. Frank Turek. How you doing, Frank?
Hey, Greg, I can barely hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, so I'll just try to amp it up just a little bit. Just want to give the our listeners the skinny on the Cross-Examined Instructors Academy event coming up in August, as we usually have it, but this time in Dallas. Tell us about what's going on this summer.
Yeah, well, in Dallas, this is our 10th annual, Greg. Can you believe this is the 10th year we're doing this?
No, I can't. It's just gone by. So, have I been there with you since the very beginning?
Of course. The first person I called was a guy by the name of Greg Kokel. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's amazing.
Oh, well, I wish my kids thought.
No, we started in Charlotte 10 years ago.
That's right.
And you were the first person I called when I said, we really need a course where apologists can come together and teach new budding apologists how to improve their presentation and question answering skills. And of course, I thought of you immediately. And I think right about that time, Tactics came out. It was maybe a year later that Tactics came out.
Well, I think
but
you're
you
right.
had Tactics already. You were teaching it in a DVD format, and you had a PDF of it, and then you wrote the book right after that.
That's
so
right.
Tactics is an essential part of the Cross-Examined Instructor Academy. So you joined me, and then we had J. Warner Wallace, and of course Brent Kunkel was there from the beginning, and now we have Bobby Conway and Sean McDowell and Richard Howe and Jorge Calderon, and we just have a great lineup that teaches people how to present and answer questions. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I really like about CIA is we've got like 3 days together full time, mornings, afternoons, most evenings, where we're not just giving information, but we're trying to coach people who've already, they're in play in some ways of trying to make a difference, speaking to Bible studies or groups or their local community church or maybe universities or wherever. It's just a full range of things. But we can help them to do what they're doing better, not just with the content, but also giving them some tips on presentation skills based on your experience and my experience and Brett's experience and really the experience of all the people on the team. Plus, it's in an environment of, you know, we're shoulder to shoulder, cozy up, being pals. We're not on a big stage where we're isolated from the people we're trying to communicate with, but we're up close. We're spending time together. We're answering questions. We're getting to know each other. And I found, boy, I love this time that we spend together, Frank, because I can just tell the kind of impact this personal attention is having in the lives of the people that we're working with at CIA.
Yes, and I second that wholeheartedly, Greg. In fact, what I love is the fact that we're with one another and all the students for the entire 3 days. We share meals together. Right. We interact with one another. We can ask questions of one another. And even when we're doing our presentations, we kind of jump in on one another
that's
and
right.
say, hey, that's a good point. Have you thought about this too?
Yeah, so I love interrupting your talks.
it's a very interactive session.
Well,
and
it feels
you get
like
to
a
hang out with the people who do this regularly.
Yeah.
Most folks who are at this seminar or this 3-day training program do this professionally. Again, the lineup it's going to be Greg and myself, plus Sean McDowell, Richard Howe, who's a professor at Southern Evangelical Seminary. And just for comic relief, Richard is not only brilliant, but he's the funniest guy there.
Yeah, he's great.
Of course, Brett Kunkel, J. Warner Wallace, Bobby Conway, the one-minute apologist,
right.
Our great social media director, Jorge Calderon. And, I mean, we've just a fabulous lineup. It's going to be in Dallas this year, Greg,
That's right.
in August. So bring your Speedo.
Well, we've been holding it on the East Coast for many years. Then last year we had our first shot out here on the West Coast and had a fabulous time. And now you're kind of straddling the East and the West there, the flyover states. In Dallas, though, a lot of Christians there, a lot of intensity about the gospel and a lot of things happening in that city. And we're looking forward to having a good turnout for Cross-Examined Instructor Academy. Give us the dates, Frank, and some of the other particulars that people who are thinking about possibly attending for that, 3 days? Give us the whole breakdown.
Sure, it's going to be August 10th to the 12th. That's a Thursday through a Saturday. And so most people, you really have to fly in if you don't live in Dallas. You got to come in Wednesday night. And it's pretty much like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. the first day. Mm-hmm. We eat all our meals together. We interact quite a bit. The second day is a day where the participants actually present back to us, the instructors, and right. we give them feedback on their presentations. They each do about a 15-minute presentation, and then we as instructors evaluate their presentation. We ask them questions. We see how good they are on their feet. We give them some tips to improve their presentation skills, and then the next day, Saturday, they come back and they do the presentation again,
right.
or a similar one again, to try and hone their presentation skills a second time.
With a different instructor.
And during this period, we're also doing presentations ourselves to right. the students, so it's a very lively 3 days. Frankly, it's a tiring 3 days, but I'm energized after the whole thing is over because yeah. As you say, we interact with one another so well, and we learn from one another. I learn a lot at CIA myself, just mm-hmm. from you and the other instructors out there. Mm-hmm. And, Greg, I you've known that this is the 10th year we're doing this. We have over 300 alumni out there. We only take between 50 and 60 people in CIA, in the mm-hmm. Cross-Examined Instructor Academy, which means people get a lot of personal attention.
That's right.
And we've had people come back year after year to take it again because there's always new twists to it. You always learn new things when
right.
you come. There's always some new presentations we're given. I think probably this year, Greg, you'll probably do something on the story of reality, I hope, to the group.
Well, I'm at your service, bro. I'd love to talk about that because it's not – if we're going to defend what we believe, we've got to have a clear picture of what it is we believe. And I think the story of reality does a very good job of laying that out for people with some soft apologetics kind of worked in there. And I'd love to do that. I was just thinking, though, about these training sessions where the students get to do their presentation for 15 minutes, and there's a handful of students in the class. We break down into groups with different instructors that give feedback. That feedback session, I love that time because I can just see in the countenance of the people that are giving their presentations. I mean, you know, it's a little bit scary to do a presentation before somebody you look up to who's been doing this more than you have and other students. But that's the way to get better. I can see it in their eyes, the satisfaction or the gratitude for giving tips to help them improve in their communication skills, to take what they have, whatever it is, and move them a little bit further on. And actually, Frank, on Saturday night, I had dinner with James Warner and his wife, Tina, here in the Los Angeles area. And he's a graduate of CIA from last year. And
uh-huh.
he told me, he said, I'll probably see you at CIA again because I'm coming back. Most likely, so I can get more of that good stuff. And he's, you know, just sitting down to talking with him, hearing what he's doing and the way he's interacting with people and the way he's meeting and presenting and the impact that he's having. Wow, it was really great. And he counts CIA as a really important stepping stone to what he's able to do now.
Well, there's nowhere else I know that you can get this kind of training in such a concentrated period of time. Again, it's 3 days. It's Thursday through Saturday. And again, this year it's going to be in Dallas at North Dallas Community Fellowship. In fact, that's the same place you guys had a rethink.
Oh, that's
long.
Right.
You had two
yeah.
rethinks there,
that
didn't
we
you?
We have, yeah, right. And likely we'll have it again in the spring in 2018. We're just skipping the fall because it's football season in the fall in Dallas. That's not a good time to have a big event. But this is in August 10th through 12th. And now, as folks want to kind of get up to speed, if they're thinking about going to this, this is a classroom setting. There's going to be some work involved. Why don't you tell them a little bit about their prep and
yeah,
what we
expect of
them?
Yeah, the prep is important. This CIA is not for people that don't know anything about apologetics. CIA, the Cross-Examined Instructor Academy, is for people that have an affinity for apologetics, are interested in it, have done some reading, maybe done some presentations themselves. Although it's not absolutely required that they do a presentation, we highly encourage it because right. That's really why people go there. That's the unique thing about CIA. Not only are you there with people that do this for a living and do it very well, but you can present to them and they can critique you. So what they need to do, and we have on our website, crossexamine.org, if they click on events and they go down to CIA, they can apply there, they can see all the requirements. But the two essential books that they have to have very well known, and they have to be able to present the core of these two books, are Tactics, your book, and I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, the book I wrote with Dr. Norman Geiser. Those are the two primary books for the course, and they've got to be very skilled in those two books. And then there's all other readings, Jay Warner's books we, of course, recommend that they read, and several others. They're all there on the website. And they've got to be ready to do, if they're going to really get the full force of CIA, they got to be ready to do a 15-minute presentation. Mm-hmm. All the details are right there on the website, and we'll send them an email that will give them some further guidance on how to do their presentations. But the second day we're there, they do a presentation, and the third day we're there, they do another presentation, refining the one they did the previous day. They've got to sign up soon, though, Greg, because this thing fills up. We can only take max 60 people.
Right.
If they go to crossexamine.org, they can click on events. They go down to CIA. They can apply. It's not cheap. It's not free. Mm-hmm. You have to make an investment. It costs a lot to put this thing on, but it's well worth it, as evidenced by the people that go to it. I mean, Greg, we've routinely, you know, at a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being the worst, 5 being the best, this course is rated near 5 all the time.
Right,
and
right.
Again, it's our 10th annual, and it's because guys like you and guys like Jay Warner and Bobby Conway and Brett Kunkel and Sean McDowell and all these other folks show up and really pour their hearts and minds into it.
Well, it's a great, exciting thing on my schedule, as I mentioned earlier. And one of the reasons we're keeping it small is because we want to give people the kind of attention that we think would be best to help facilitate their growth and become a more effective presenter to make a difference. And for us, this is leverage time. It's a smaller group that we're dealing with, but we know that the impact that this group is going to have down the line is going to be fantastic. You know, you mentioned about doing the presentation, as this is part of the program, but it's optional. Sometimes people do come and say, you know, I don't really want to present. I'm remembering some folks who came the first year and said they don't want to present, and then they came around the next year and said, you know what, I'm going to present this time because I saw the benefit that accrued to the people who did that last time around.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. So, I mean, where else are you going to get this kind of training? You're not. You're never going to be in front of these people who have honed their skills presenting this kind of information in a winsome and effective way than if you come to CIA.
Sure.
And so you might as well take advantage of it. I mean, we're not going to bite your head off.
No, we're going to
be honest with you on how you can improve yourself, and the other students will evaluate you as well. So it's really a very robust environment where you can really get you can make a lot of progress in a short period of time, let me put it that way.
Yeah, and you know, every single one of us, too, and for the names that you read out, most of our listeners know, we are all doing this on an ongoing basis with a wide variety of audiences, and so we're going to bring our best understanding of what we've learned about doing these kinds of things and make it available to your students. In fact, it just occurred to me that in, little more than a week, you and I are going to be in New York City.
That's right.
Long Island. We're going to be doing an event for a bunch of folk that were at a CIA a few years ago.
That's right. Nick and Anthony of New York Apologetics. Forget about it. We're going there, Greg. We're going all the way to New York.
Yeah, that's right.
Next weekend, which is, let's see, the 28th, 29th of April.
Yeah, we'll be on Long Island, and I'm looking forward to seeing you then. And, we just got a Mary Jo's going to be there, Mary Jo Sharp, and I, the three of us will be working with them, and we'll be doing that conference. But that's a connection with the CIA, because these guys were getting trained by us a few years back, 2 or 3 years back, and they're really doing a great work there in Long Island, and we want to support that.
In fact, Greg, they have come several times to CIA, and they've brought people with them. So they Nick and Anthony are great folks up there in New York, and they're digging some hard ground up there, but
that's
they're doing a great job.
And
that's what we want people to do all over the country. Greg, I've heard you say it so many times at CIA, to people who are interested in this, bloom, where you're planted.
That's it. Yeah.
You can make an impact right where you are. You don't have to travel the country doing this stuff. You can do it right in your own backyard. Unpack that for people a little
bit. That's right. Well, a lot of times I get this question asked of me, well, how could I do what you do? And I think of something I heard somebody say a long time ago, and what he said was, unless you are in the ministry before you get in the ministry, you won't be in the ministry when you go in the ministry, or something like that. The point is you got to start where you're at. You can't look on the horizon and say, one of these days I'm going to be out there doing this stuff, making an impact for Christ. He was faithful in small things, will be given larger things. That's what Jesus said. And so we want people to take the circumstances they're in, the people that are around them, maybe it's a Bible study or discipleship group or their own local church where they can serve in some capacity transferring this information. By going to CIA, we help them to hone their skills. Let's just put it that way. We help them to hone their skills to use those capabilities in the environments that God has already placed them in. And in the process of doing that, growing and developing, and then that's when the Lord opens up other doors to do maybe larger or greater things. You got to bloom where you're planted, and we'll help you do that at CIA. Give the skinny on that once again, the summary of dates, times, the whole deal.
Yeah, it's April. It's August 10th to the 12th in Dallas, Texas. If they go to crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it, and they click on events, they will see events there, CIA, down there in the menu. And it has all the details on how they apply. It's not free. You have to make an investment. You have to get lodging. In fact, the place we're doing it this year, Greg, has two nice hotels right in the parking lot.
Right across the park.
So
I've stayed there.
Extremely convenient.
Right.
We eat most of our meals together when we go to CIA. August 10th to the 12th. Again, Greg Kokel, myself, Frank Turek, Sean McDowell, Richard Howe, Brett Kunkel, J. Warner Wallace, the one-minute apologist, Bobby Conway, Jorge Gil Calderon, our social media director, who just gives people some great insights on how to expand their ministry on the Internet. Well, we may have a guest lecturer or two as well, depending upon how many people sign up.
Those have been people like William Dembski or Gary Habermas or Hank Hanegraaff. I mean, you've got like some major players that have just shown up
for
the event. And so you never know what's going to happen. So, Frank, I'm looking forward to August 10th through 12th, but I'm also looking forward to, 10 days from now, we're going to be hanging out at Long Island doing our thing in New York. I don't get up in that neck of the woods very often. That's your stomping grounds. That's where you're from. But New Jersey, and the like. But it'll be fun getting together with you then and also this summer. August 10th through 12th, crossexamined.org. That's where you can get all the info. Frank, thanks so much.
Greg, thanks for having me on, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks. And then August 10 to 12 in Dallas. It's going to be great.
All right, will do. Hang in there, buddy.
See you.
Bye-bye. He is always a lot of fun to hang out with. And whether, on the air or in person, now you get a chance to hang out with him in person and a whole bunch of other fabulous people, Sean McDowell, Brett Kunkel, Bobby Conway, J. Warner Wallace, Richard Howe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all part of Cross Examined Instructor Academy. CrossExamined.org. That's where all the info is. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back to you on Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. Can churches discipline for the sin of homosexuality? Find out my answer in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the top of the homepage at str.org.
Would you like Greg, Brett, Alan, or Tim to come and speak at a location near you? Find out how you can invite them to your area by visiting the speaker section at str.org. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To schedule Greg, Brett, Alan, or Tim today, send an email to Melinda or Danielle To learn more, visit str.org/training/speakers.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, and I need a Xanax after I talk with Frank. Man, I love that guy, and I love working with him. And yeah, it's been 10 years since we've been doing CIA. That's super. I was pleasantly surprised last week to go to a Christian film that did not embarrass me. And in a certain sense, I was pleasantly surprised that that was the case, but I kind of expected a cut above with this film, the films that I'd seen in the past that passed as Christian films. And we've talked about different things here on the show, and I know you guys know what I'm talking about. A lot of these films that are Christian films with the gospel, etc., are often made for other Christians and to get Christians cheering and yay for our side, and they, I'm sure they have a residual impact on people who watch them who are not Christians, and God does all kinds of good things when his gospel is portrayed in a clear fashion, okay? Sometimes the production values are not up to snuff. Sometimes the acting is not up to snuff. Sometimes the writing is not up to snuff. But we can rejoice that God can use all kinds of things. That's why it's particularly satisfying when I go to see a film that is meant to represent what I believe in dramatic form and does it right, in my view. In the past, I've been actually quite critical. I like to think, in a good sense, that is, I've asked the right questions about the films that represent our view, and sometimes when I see these films, they're just things they could have really improved on or they could have done better. And I mean, just to see a film, a Christian film, that doesn't have the line, "What is your heart telling you to do?" in it is a big plus. And this film doesn't have that line in there, thankfully, because that's the wrong line. That's not a Christian epistemology. What is your heart telling you to do? In any event, you probably know the film I'm talking about. It's called The Case for Christ, after the book by Lee Strobel. And if you've read the book, you know that the book is a chronicle of sorts of an odyssey that Lee Strobel makes as a reporter for the Chicago Tribune and an atheist. And his wife becomes a Christian, and then he's got to deal with that as an atheist, and it's not easy for him. And he figures the best way to disabuse her of her bizarre new beliefs is to demonstrate that Christianity is false. And the best way, following the facts as a good reporter, to demonstrate that Christianity is false is to show that the resurrection never happened, which is a sound strategy. I sometimes will start a talk by saying, when you think about it, there are a lot of ways to demonstrate that Christianity is false, which is not what the people listening expected me to say. They don't expect a speaker to say something like that. But the fact is, in principle, it's true. There are ways, in principle, lots of ways to demonstrate that Christianity is false. I mean, look, our story starts in the beginning God. If there's no God, there's no story, right? We're Christians. We follow Jesus. If there's no Jesus, there's no Christianity. Or if Jesus is significantly different than the Jesus of the New Testament, then there's no Christianity. And on and on and on. And one of these things that are central and a point of falsifiability is the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, to which Paul says, if that event did not happen, if we are believing in the resurrection contrary to fact, then we are of all people to be pitied. People should feel sorry for us if we are believing in some mythology. I'll probably later in the show I'll have more to say about the so-called mythology of the resurrection, but I just want you to see that if you're going to go after Christianity and prove it to be false, this is a good way to do it. This is a sound strategy. Demonstrate that it's not reasonable to believe the resurrection ever happened, and you pretty much can cut the legs out from underneath the Christian faith. And so that was the strategy of Lee Strobel, at least as the book is characterized in the film. At the beginning of the film, it says, based on a true story, which means now you're going to have the essence of what Lee went through, but you're going to have fictional, dramatical elements that are kind of built into the story or written in that maybe didn't happen, but help to carry the substance of the story along for a movie-going audience, okay? And I actually don't know which parts of the film are completely accurate to Lee's life and which ones are drama. But I will tell you this, the thing fits together seamlessly. It was pitch perfect. I was there with my wife and my daughters, and my 12-year-old was happy to go. My 9-year-old wasn't that happy. She wanted to see some cartoon thing, some animated thing. That was also playing. No, those things are boring, Papa. I don't want to watch that, the 9-year-old, right? But she stayed fixed to the movie the entire time. And the reason that she stayed fixed is because the dramatic elements worked. From the very beginning to the very end, there is a drama that is unfolding, not just an apologetics argument, but a drama. And the drama works. It's engaging. It's actually touching at numerous points. I actually found myself getting choked up at a couple of different points where my heart was actually stirred by the human element in the story, the dynamism, or dynamic, I should say, of the unfolding storyline. Now, this happens a lot with non-Christian films. I mean, this isn't unique because it's, you know, about Jesus or Christianity or something. That's not my point. My point is that there is a very human story that is the foil for making the case for Christianity, the case for Christ, and that story is emotionally engaging. And not the least reason being that the characters, or should say the actors that portray the two main characters, which are Lee and his wife, and also the characters, you know, in the Tribune and those that represent people like William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas and the like, these characters are completely believable. And the actors who portray them are entirely up to the task. And I'm thinking about the kinds of moments that are really difficult to portray. So here you've got Lee, the atheist, discovering that his wife has become a Christian for largely subjectivistic reasons. I'd never felt this way before. I just knew in my heart this was true. No, I'm not putting that down. I think there's a place for that kind of thing, but it wouldn't appeal to Lee Strobel before Christ. He needed the facts. And so the conflict that this character then experiences, having to field the reality of his wife going in an entirely different direction than he ever expected. Wow. I think that's a challenging job for an actor, and I frankly don't even have the actor's name in front of me, but he carries it out. And in the conversion scene, both of the characters managed to carry this scene without seeming schmarmy, and in fact, for me, it was very, very touching. So, wow, I've never seen anything like this before. It was pitch perfect. No false moves, nothing embarrassing. I mean, this is from a guy who thinks if it's a Christian film and they just, you know, they don't embarrass me, then they're doing pretty well. No, there's nothing embarrassing here, but far beyond that. It was perfectly cast. It was meticulously acted. It was really skillfully written. There are all kinds of lines in there that just work really well. And this is especially true when Lee is traveling around trying to find good reasons to reject the evidence of the resurrection. And so he's pursuing some angle of argument, some line of argument, like the swoon theory, for example, that Jesus didn't really die. And so he goes to a medical professional. And I don't know who this guy is, and I don't know who the actor is, but he does a fabulous job. The amount of poignant, compelling apologetics that is fit inside of a 3 to 5 minute interview in a way that sounds natural and believable and compelling, it's amazing to me. That's good writing. And so I was really happy for that part. I knew the content would be good in that regard. It's Lee Strobel, after all. It's the case for Christ, after all. The content's going to be good. But he didn't write the screenplay. Somebody else did. And whoever it was, again, these are no names to me. They are people I've never heard of before. Whoever it was that did that work did a magnificent job. Now, you don't have to believe me, though. I just encourage you to watch the movie, all right? I think it was a masterful characterization of the evidence and a masterful communication of a life of a skeptic who kept stumbling across the answers he did not want to stumble across. And he says that at one line. He says, you know, that wasn't the answer that I was hoping to get from you. Speaking here to one of the specialists that he discussed, that he was pushing back on or going to get information to try to disqualify the evidence for the resurrection. So the drama kept me engaged. It moved me. Many of you know I never use any of these accolades lightly, especially when it comes to faith films. As I said, I'm usually pretty happy if no damage has been done. But the case for Christ goes far beyond that, and I'm comfortable saying it's simply the best film of this kind that I've ever seen. I can't think of anything that even comes close to this. So mark your calendar, take your family, take your friends. You will not be embarrassed, and I think you will have plenty of opportunity for productive conversation when you do. All right, I think we're going to take an early break here, and then I'll get to my caller when we return here on Stand to Reason.
Students, who's waiting for you? Parents, pastors, who is waiting for your students? When they leave the safety of your home or your church, who will they encounter? What kind of challenges will they face? The fact is that the majority of our young people are not ready for the intellectual and moral challenges they'll face, not only on the college campus, but on the high school campus or junior high campus. And that is why they need to go to Rethink. Bring your students to the Rethink Apologetics Student Conference in Birmingham, Alabama on April 21st and 22nd. Go to rethinkapologetics.com for more information.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of Ambassador's Guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, Postmodernism, the New Atheists, Pluralism, Understanding Homosexuality, and The Voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Coakley, your host. And let's see. Okay, from Montana somewhere, Abby. Welcome to the show, Abby.
Mr. Coakley, thank you for taking my call. It's an honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you. You know, your name is the nickname of my daughter, Annabeth. We call her A.B., Annabeth, Abby.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think this. I think you're the. I don't know if this is actually true, but my impulse is to think that this is the first Abby that I've ever had on the program that I know of, except for my own Abby, because that name jumps out to me so strongly. So nice to have you on board, Abby.
Thank you. I'm a Summit graduate, and
good for you.
Jay Warner actually recommended your book Tactics to me, and so I'm somewhat familiar with your work, and I found it very helpful.
Good. I owe him
so
a dollar.
I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, good.
I did have a few questions for you. So when I came back from Summit, I had an 18-year-old atheist friend of mine. He used to be a Mennonite, but he said I started looking into things, and I decided it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being at Summit really helped me, and so I just, one day I said, Olaf, what is it that has caused you to doubt? And one of the main things he said to me was, well, look at a passage like Romans 9, 11 through 24.
Mm-hmm.
He said, looking at this, it seems to say plainly that God creates some people specifically for destruction. Now, how is that fair? And I wasn't sure how to answer him, so
yeah.
I was wondering what you would say.
Well, let me just offer a couple of thoughts, kind of as preliminary thoughts here. One of them is, it always strikes me unusual that people will read something like what you've referred to in Romans 9 and find this difficult, which I acknowledge the difficulty with it, but find it difficult and therefore stop believing in God. Because the problem is that person has got to then adopt another point of view. And presumably that point of view is atheism. So God doesn't exist because I don't like this stuff that I see here. I don't understand it, or it doesn't strike me as right. It's not just. But then when, I don't know, is your friend, would he consider himself an atheist now?
Yes, he considers himself very much an atheist, but, okay. Well, that's what he says.
Okay,
know,
well, see, here's the irony. And now, this doesn't answer any questions. This is not meant to parry the objection. I'll get to this in a minute. But here's the irony. He is offended by something he reads in Romans because he thinks that it is unjust. That means that God is in violation of some kind of objective moral principle of justice, and so he can't believe in a God who seems to be immoral. And so his response to that is to adopt a worldview in which the concept of morality itself is non-existent. And what I mean by that is, I mean, in atheism, there is no such thing as objective, transcendent morality. There are just things that happen, and people assign whatever values to those things they want. That's relativism. Or maybe people wrongly believe, because they've been tricked by evolution, to think some things are wrong and some things are right, when in fact no action has any moral value. Do you see the point? It seems like his antidote is worse than the disease. He's adopting a whole worldview in which morality is non-existent, irrelevant, incoherent, because he doesn't like something he reads in the Bible that implies to him that God is not just.
Yes.
So I don't know why that doesn't trouble him. I don't know why it doesn't trouble him that his new worldview leaves absolutely no room at all for moral claims, which, by the way, now renders his objection almost meaningless. All he could say is, all right, the fact is there is no God, so there is no morality, so I can't really accuse your God of being immoral when there's not really any immorality. But what I can do is I can say, on your terms, in your system, then your God is acting in a way that, according to your belief system, is immoral, and so there's an internal contradiction to your view. All right, now he could do that. But the problem is, on our view, God is perfectly holy. So anything that looks like immorality to us when we look in the Scripture is not immorality. It's something we're not understanding properly. That is, if he's going to take simply from the inside of our worldview and try to show that there's a contradiction, okay? So all I'm doing so far is I'm just saying that the objection strikes me as odd, given the fact that the alternative that your friend has adopted is a worldview that makes nonsense of any moral judgments. I should say any objective moral judgments, but that's the kind of moral judgment he's making against God here in Romans 9. Now, having said that, and I think you follow that pretty well, and probably a lot of our listeners do, and this is one of the reasons why taking the bottom-up approach is a mistake. That is, looking at little things that bug you and then dismissing God, that's a mistake. Rather, what you ought to do is go top-down, and that is, what worldview in general seems to be most defensible, whether it's a theistic worldview or an atheistic worldview, and look at the consequences of those. Now, I think there's a lot of good reasons to believe in the theistic worldview. That means I'm going to approach these problems from the basis of a theistic worldview, not from the basis of a doubter. Because if I'm a doubter, that gives me other problems if I'm going to be an atheist, as I pointed out. So what I'm thinking about is I got good reasons to believe that God does exist, and in fact that the Bible speaks for God, that God speaks through the Bible in an authoritative way. But I'm going to run across places like Romans that has, let's just call them imponderables a little bit, okay? They're things that are, man, how does that work? And I'll just tell you frankly, Abby, there's a lot of times when I'm faced with that question and I'm not able to answer it, all right? Mm-hmm. How does that work, okay? So when I read through in Romans 9, I don't know that I'm going to be able to answer all the questions because they're questions that I have as well. And we see a description in that passage of God making choices about how he is going to work and how he's going to dispense grace. Now that it's by itself, in my view, is not an imponderable. A grace simply means unmerited favor. That is, God gives favor that is not due to the one whom he favors. Well, if it's not due him and it's not due anybody, then he can dispense it as he wills, and there is no obligation to be fair if fairness means everybody gets the same. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say, Abby, you owed me $100, and your friend that you're speaking of now, let's just call him Jim for the sake of discussion, and Jim owed me $100 too. Let's just say there are bona fide debts, it would be appropriate for me to expect you to pay it, okay? But what mm-hmm. if I told Jim, I said, hey, Jim, forget about it. I'm not going to forget about it. I'm just wiping the slate clean. You don't owe me $100 anymore. Am I now obligated, Abby, to erase your debt as well?
No,
I'm not. And I'm glad that you see that. If the debt is owed me, I can do what I will with that which is owed me. And if I forgive one, I am not obliged to forgive another. It is completely up to me. And that is the situation we see here. God can call, say, Jacob, but not Esau. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, verse 13 here. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that God hated in the sense that we think of hate, that he had vicious animosity towards him. That's not what the phraseology is referring to. Remember, Jesus says you have to hate your mother and brother and sister in order to follow me. Well, he didn't mean that you have a attitude of hatred towards them. It means that you have to follow me with utter faithfulness, even if it means rejecting your own family members, okay? And so by comparison, it's a love-hate kind of thing. You're loving Jesus so much, but you're hating or denying your family members. It doesn't mean you have animosity towards them. And that's what's going on here. Jacob is the one who is selected for divine grace not Esau. Now, of course, this at least suggests to some an injustice. And therefore, Paul responds to the what he knows people are going to say. Verse 14, what shall we say then? There's no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. In other words, he's saying God is not unjust. For he says to Moses, verse 15, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. And so there's the lesson that I was just offering you. God can forgive and have mercy on anyone he wants. And he can punish any guilty one he wants. Notice, by the way, that he can only forgive and have mercy on people who need forgiveness and need mercy, right?
Yeah.
Which is everybody. So some he chooses to forgive and some he chooses not to. And on my view, that is completely within his rights. God can do what he wants. There's no injustice with him. That is, if he punishes somebody, it's only because they're guilty. He's not punishing the innocent in virtue of their innocence. He is only punishing the guilty. And others that are guilty, he gives mercy and grace, and he's able to do that because he's already punished his own son for that. And so he is both, as he says earlier in the book of Romans, both the just and the justifier of him who has faith in Christ. Now, there is the imponderable, though, and this is a question I've been asked many times, and it's one I've asked myself. Why? It's not a question of justice so much, but why is it that God created people that he knew would rebel against him and not respond to his mercy? Why did he do that? And the answer to that question is, I don't know. And in fact, and I've said this many times on the program, most questions that start out with why did God or why didn't God simply cannot be answered. And they can't be answered because God himself does not tell us. And if he doesn't reveal his mind on something, we might take a couple of stabs at it. We might make an educated guess, but we can't speak in most cases with any confidence that we have the right answer. These are imponderables. As we read through Romans 9, what we see is God calling the shots. Again, back in verse 15, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. It's my mercy, it's my compassion, I can dole it out as I wish. And even if we would wish it to be otherwise, and even if we would do otherwise if it were us, or so we think, it doesn't mean that God himself can be faulted for distributing his mercy according to, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 1, the kind intention of his will. Now, it does say here in verse 18, he has mercy on whom he has, on whom he desires, and he hardens whom he desires. You know, that looks like God is causing the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's making people hard. I don't think that's what's going on there. And I was just thinking about this the other day. In Romans chapter 1, remember Romans is an argument, it's a book that has unity to it. It starts in one place and it grows and develops into another place. Paul is trying to explain something really important. At the very beginning, he says that God has created man, and man, even without the revelation of the Bible, can know basic things about God without any help. In fact, they know enough to be responsible. But what they do with the knowledge they've been given is they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That's Paul's language, okay? And this makes God mad, all right? So what does God do, though? It's interesting how it says. He says, even though they did not Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. So they got darkened in their rebellion. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then that's verse 21 of chapter 1. You go to verse 24. I'm not reading it all because it's not as relevant to my particular point. What is God's response to man's rebellion? It says, therefore God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity. That's verse 24. Verse 25, verse 26, for this reason God gave them over to degrading passions. Verse 28, and just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind. Now, I had never made this connection before. I never had this idea before, but it just occurred to me just a couple of days ago, believe it or not, when I was reading this, that this passage in Romans 1 may be connected to Romans 9, verse 18. So then he has mercy on whom he desires, and he hardens whom he desires. That's a Romans 9 verse. Let me reread it again. I mean, I'm just going to do a substitute phrase, and you tell me if it doesn't make sense to you. So he has mercy on whom he desires, and he gives them over when whoever he desires. I just wonder if this is not talking about the same thing. That is, God is simply hardening those who are already hardened towards him and going the other direction, and he just lets them go, and he gives them over.
And it goes back to personal autonomy. Well, if they wanted to be hardened in the first place, God's not going to keep, you know, pursuing someone who doesn't want to be pursued.
Well, they are following the dictates of their fallen nature. And so God is just letting that go. He rescues those who he desires to rescue, and he lets everyone else simply, he gives them over. He continues, they continue in their own sin, and then they get the due penalty of their error. They get the punishment that is appropriate for their rebellion. And again, we see Paul playing the same theme that God has the right to do what he wants with his own. And we see that in verse 21 of Romans 9. Or does not the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump of one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? And so, and then he continues with the thought. So I know some of the language here is troubling. It's troubling for me too. But the real question is, can God do what he wants with his own mercy and forgiveness and compassion and love? And or is he obliged to give everybody exactly the same? I think the first, not the second. And I see we see this being played out here. People who rebel against God are given over, and they get what they deserve. So God is not just. People who are forgiven do not get what they deserve. They get mercy because Jesus got what they deserve, and therefore justice is maintained. I don't know if that's going to help you much there. I've been doing a lot of talking here on this, and I think it's a hard passage, but does that help a little bit?
That does help. That helps quite a bit, actually, so I thank you for that.
Sure. I understand you also had a question about the Trinity, though. Is that right?
That's true. So I guess to kind of set the stage here, I don't know how I want to say this.
Well, maybe do this. Instead of giving the, because we only got about 3 minutes left, why don't you just give me kind of the question itself in the simplest form, and I'll do my best to answer it.
Okay. So there are some Christians that hold to what we call the Arian heresy, that Jesus is less than God but more than man.
Yes, but that wouldn't be Christians. By definition, they would be something else, maybe Jehovah's Witnesses. But yeah, there is that view.
Okay.
Less than God, but more than man.
I read, and I'm not sure this is true, I was hoping you'd help me, I read that this heresy predates Arius and was actually held for hundreds of years by Coptic Christians before Arius ever entered the scene.
That could be. He was just a well-known promoter of that. Arius was 4th century. So there were all kinds of Christological heresies that were in play before the 4th century, obviously.
Mm-hmm. So, as the church, we have not been consistent with presenting the Trinity as we now understand it. Why is it so hard to understand? Everything else seems fairly straightforward.
Well, A lot could be said about the way you just put that question. I would not say it's true that as a church we haven't been clear. Just because there were people in the larger Christian circles that didn't hold this view does not mean they were part of the church. In fact, this was the discussion. These people don't belong. They promote a different religious view about Jesus. The real analysis or the real issue is, what does the text teach? And when it comes to the issue of what later became known as the Trinity, and Tertullian in the late second century was the first one to use the term, what does the text say about the details of that teaching? And to me, it's pretty straightforward. There are three elements to the Trinity. That is, there is one God. Two, that the Father, Son, and the Spirit are separate persons. Three, that each is equally God. There it is. You have one nature and three centers of consciousness that are distinct from each other. Now, all you have to demonstrate in the Scripture, by the way, that's not complicated. That's weird, but what I just said is not complicated, okay? It's straightforward. It's unusual. There are no analogs in the rest of creation. But it doesn't mean it's false, and it doesn't mean it's contradictory. It's not. It's just odd. How do we know whether that is the true teaching of Scripture? All we have to do is see if the Scripture teaches clearly each of those three things. Does it teach there's one God? Yes. Does it teach that the Father and the Son and the Spirit are distinct persons from each other? Yes, they interact in personal ways. Does it teach that each is God? The answer is yes. They are each called God. They each perform divine functions, and they each receive, they exercise divine prerogatives, like are worshipped, for example. This is all we need to demonstrate to show that the Trinity is taught in Scripture. That's all. So in that sense, it's actually quite straightforward. And what I would recommend is that you take a look at our teaching. We have some teaching called The Trinity, a Solution, Not a Problem. You can get that at str.org. And there's also a chapter where I talk about Jesus in the book, The Story of Reality. Who is Jesus? And I discuss the nature of the Trinity there. And I think that you will find that to be maybe instructive or insightful in at least how we lay the notion out and in some ways how we defend it. That's all I've got for you, Abby. I hope that's helpful. And I really had a nice time chatting with you. Thanks so much. That's it, friends, for this hour. Thanks for spending it with me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.